Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here. Today's Sunday, February 17th, 2019. And this is essentially just a continuation of the talk that I started last April. Hard to believe it's been 10 months. But so that was originally titled Dharma and Depression, so pretty much only was able to cover the depression portion of it. So wasn't able to tie it into the Zen practice, which is, I guess, kind of important here. So again, I think I did last time, just for people who don't know me, a little disclaimer that I'm not any sort of healthcare professional to offer advice or any authority on Zen teaching. So this is just my it's my own experience of what this what this life is for this white heterosexual male with no children. So your mileage may vary. let's see. So yeah, it's not a chance for me to say, oh, poor me, give me your pity, listen to my story. It's especially after my last talk, the number of people who responded, either personally or just email, especially made me realize that a large number of people who are also dealing with some form of depression or mental illness, and how much sharing one's experience, how helpful that can be, and oftentimes it can feel very, very isolating, and because being withdrawn is one of those symptoms. So yeah, in the first part there, I played some podcasts from various interviews with people that. Especially the one that's helped me the most is The Hilarious World of Depression, it's great because it mostly focuses on people who are comedians. At least that's how it started out, and now it's more people and various public figures in some way or another. I think the first what grabbed me to that was the first episode was it Robert Siegel, the Wait, Don't Tell Me host. And it's like many people, it's like, what? He can't be depressed. He's always so funny and so on top of it. But as many people who deal with it realize, that's not the case. It's easy to find a way to, I guess, avoid interactions with people during times of depression, or at least just learn to put on a whatever the socially acceptable persona. It's especially easy to withdraw and be in your own little world with emails and texts. You can always respond, and if somebody says, oh, how you doing? Oh, fine. Or no, I'm just a little bit under the weather, but a little smiley face emoji. But you're not gonna bother everybody all the time with your personal issues. So yeah, last time, in my continuous effort to make things difficult for myself, I played some audio clips from podcasts, and this time I'm gonna try something a little bit different. So I have plenty of information to talk forever, I'm sure, but I wanted to open it up to people with to hear people's own comments or questions. So if at any point while I'm talking, and if somebody wants me to clarify something or expand on something, whatever, or share your own experience and how something's been helpful, it's then feel free to just whatever chime in. And for those people playing at home, I thought I would try to do a little live, whatever, you can text me, we can. You'll hear your questions and comments live on air. So I'll give a number in a little bit if there's anybody out there listening. I know there's a few people who are listening, and some of them have my number already. And feel free to text me. And if not, I have my Google number I can give you, because if I don't know you, I don't want you to have my phone number. Don't know who's out there listening. So yeah, I'll say that in a little bit. Let's see. Well, I'll say it right now, then I'll repeat it. But so the number I have here is 585-861-8160. And if you call now, you get a free tote bag. So yeah, I think to repeat one thing, I think the one clip that I played last time was Andrew Solomon. He was author of The Noonday Demon, Atlas on Depression, something like that. I have the audiobook. It's long, and I haven't gone through the whole thing yet. It's very dense, and chock full of good information. So yeah, his one quote that really stuck with me to help people who don't understand it, or maybe know somebody who's dealing with it and not quite understanding what it is. But he said the opposite of depression is not happiness; it's vitality. And there's often the kind of misunderstanding. Oh, it's just somebody's in a bad mood or sad, and it goes well beyond that. And I'll get into that in a little bit. That led me to an article in The Guardian here. Let's see, it is titled "Depression Doesn't Make You Sad All the Time" by S.E. Smith. And it's Saturday the 3rd, January 2015. And so she says, "One of the most popular, enduring, and irritating myths about depression is that it means depressed people are sad all the time, and that by extension, people who are happy can't be experiencing depression, even if they say they are. It is a skewed and horrible version of depression, and it's one that further stigmatizes the condition and isolates people with depression and related mental health conditions. This is because, put bluntly, depression doesn't make you sad all the time, though the level of sadness a patient experiences can, of course, vary depending on the individual and the severity of depression." We have this umbrella term of depression, and it's, you know, there's many flavors that can be experienced, and it's becoming realized that the more we have research and scientists and the tools to really explore the human brain and psychology and neuroscience, and using these tools, we're really getting in there and seeing how these different mechanisms work. And so probably in 50 years, the term depression will just seem so outdated, as if it's like the 1800s and somebody's saying they have the vapors, or basing our medical our medical diagnosis on the four humors. Let's see. So yeah, to tie it in, I think my last talk, there's one way for me to find out what I said in my last talk, and that would be for me to listen to it. But there's no way I'm going to go listen to myself on the audio. So, going by my notes here, think I started trying to tie it into my own practice with Zen by talking about when I was on staff before in the early 2000s. 2002. For one of my summer breaks, I went for a long hike up in Vermont, and on the long trail. It was for about a week and a half, and just really, really that was my first solo big hike like that, and just really allowed me to, I guess, find a really quiet place in my mind, and really was quite transforming, I guess you could say. And then the day after returning from that vacation / trip, I was back here in Arnold Park, and getting settled into my room, and that was September 11th, 2001, and kind of was a jarring transition back into the real world. And at that point, I felt like my practice, my Zen practice, was kind of really stale, and I wasn't really putting my all into it, I guess. It was just, I was just going through the motions, but on that day, anybody who's here remembers that, and that was the first time seeing Roshi, then Sensei, crying, just bawling after we were all watching the news coverage and seeing people jumping out of buildings and all that. There's just the terror and all that grief. And up to that point, I think my relationship with Roshi, I was kind of, I was, how old was I, 25 or 6, and just kind of, he was just another authority figure and whatever, just trying to make life hard for me or whatever. So I was seeing that side of him, and the human side, it kind of, dropped down some sort of a barrier that I had created, and really allowed me to, I guess, trust him in some way that, and allowed me to really engage with the practice, and had that desire to give it a shot. Let's see. So yeah, that, and then it was, I was working on Mu at the time, and this is, I think I mentioned before, I had asked Roshi about bringing this up in my first talk, and because it's not common that we talk about our own practice or koan work with people, but he thought it could be helpful in the way that I was presenting it, and he had some concerns about it maybe being discouraging to people in some way, but yeah, so it was that that October 2001 that, yeah, I remember just really just deciding, like, this is it. I'm giving it my all, and yeah, that's the sesshin that he passed me on Mu. And up to that point, I think, like anybody who's working on koans, it's kind of this idea that, oh, passing Mu, all of a sudden, that's just gonna, everything's gonna be just peachy after that, and the world is gonna be my oyster. But a little foreshadowing, that's not the case. After that, it was so probably a year after that is when I left staff, and leaving staff saying, oh, okay, yeah, just, well, I passed Mu, great, kind of riding that wave still, and think, oh, that's good enough for me. I'm, I was always happy with getting B's and C's in school. It was enough to pass. I'll just ride this out, and life is good. And, I was getting married, yeah. Let's see. Oh yeah, and so soon after that sesshin and passing Mu, I was then out of Chapin Mill again, and what I realized later now is that I did have a major depressive episode, which I had thought it was some sort of illness that I had contracted from maybe I picked up something hiking and drinking the water or somehow was ill. It's just as I've described to people before, kind of having a major depressive episode. To me, feels like having the flu but without the fever. Pretty much everything else is having kind of hot flashes and chills and aching and just wanting to do nothing but lay in bed and draw the covers over my head and withdraw from the world. And so yeah, I had that feeling, but there wasn't. I remember going to the doctor and saying, oh, do you have any family history of depression? Or, no, I don't. But again, in retrospect, I see plenty of it in my family, and it's just that it was never talked about or never even diagnosed. I mean, my family, I think like many people's families of that generation, you suck it up and don't bother people with your problems and what it is, and you self-medicate however you have to. After that, I think I was kind of like, clearly I have some real illness, something physiological that was bothering me, but so kind of just brushed it off, and eventually after a few weeks things leveled off and I was on my way. So going back to the practice and working with a teacher, I've come to see it as, obviously you have to really develop trust in a teacher, and there's been too many occasions where that trust has been betrayed by various teachers that we've heard of around the world. But I feel fortunate to have one that I really trust, and the way I feel like my practice has unfolded is it's kind of been like, you just like is often said in encouragement talks, you just gotta get down and do the work, and to me it felt like just being faced with a hallway of 1,000 doors that you just got to open each door and see what's behind there until you find the correct one, and having a teacher that can confirm it, like, okay, that's the door. But so if that's just the first step, and then going through that door is there's a whole nother journey beyond it. But just knowing at least that you got kind of found a way out of that overwhelming hallway of thousands of doors. It's a good start. And having a teacher to work with to encourage you to continue going, that's a big gift, really. I guess I'll repeat that number again for anybody who wanted to. Let's see if anybody wanted to grab a pen or something. 585-861-8160. My practice has brought up my continuing conflict with trust versus control, having control over a situation, control over my life. I know I've heard from other people with I think it's a pretty common human condition. The constant need to feel like I'm in control of the situation, and if things start to get difficult, then my habit through much of my teens and 20s was to, just time to pick up and move and go start anew and kind of become a new person if you move somewhere or do something and do do something, some find a different job, or find new friends. And there's kind of that rush of just that newness, whether it's a new relationship or moving to a new place, and you have to find your way around. And I guess it's kind of that beginner's mind sense of just really that everything is new and shiny. But then once you get used to things, it gets old and dull. And then the suicidal thoughts that typically come up within depression, I think for people who really are just so feel so oppressed by their condition and thoughts. For me, I think the kind of suicide, the thoughts of suicide, are maybe like the one last way of feeling in control. Maybe that's like the one. Everything else kind of just feels out of one's control. So I think that's kind of the lure of that, and because there's plenty of evidence now to show that people who have attempted and lived, they immediately, if they are jumping off a bridge, they immediately have thought, oh, I shouldn't have done that. And probably, I mean, a part of that might be that all of a sudden you're getting quite a rush of adrenaline and all of a sudden feeling alive again, I'm sure. And, which I think was a big part of me of self-medicating, was finding some ways to, you know, the adventure sports and finding a adrenaline rush in some way. And the Zen practice over the years has revealed to me that, accepting that major depression, major depressive episode, is not just simply a mind state. As we know, this body and mind are not separate. And even though in modern medicine and science, or at least in recent years, up until recently, it was always thought of the two separate things, the brain or mind and the physical symptoms and states. But this, relating to Zen practice, one's moods are clearly strongly affected by thoughts, and negative thoughts seem to be the most common, or maybe the most convenient, especially when in a depressed mood. It's very easy to beat oneself up rather than being positive for whatever reason. But when there are those clear periods and easier times of life to enjoy, or at least to get through life, I found that's really, if I have a regular Zen practice and take advantage of those times, because it can be difficult to even be motivated to sit when you're really in a low spot like that. But making hay while the sun is shining, really concentrating on Zen practice will really prepare you for those difficult times. And I have a note here, I guess, but was from my previous talk. Here was an analogy to practicing tennis that Roshi gave during a Taisho, and it looks like it was day two of the April Sesshin last year. And I didn't go back to listen, but I seem to recall him talking about how professional athletes or musicians, just the constant practicing, it's even though it's it might not be fun or just doing it and just to embody that that practice prepares them for those difficult times in the middle of a competition or performance where just getting the thoughts out of the way and just trusting that your body's memory. Let's see. So we got our first text here. I think it might be incomplete. It says, any thoughts asking an older family member to, and then it cuts off. So, any thoughts asking an older member to see that she may be depressed and getting her to come back to sitting and seek some professional advice? There's a within that podcast that I mentioned, the Hilarious World of Depression, they always talk about on the website. They talk about some resources for dealing with family members. And it's tricky because I think I've got some responses from people before talking about who have family members who they know are clinically depressed and they want to be helpful, but at the same time, from personal experience, when having a family member or loved one just constantly barraging you with questions of are you okay? Are you okay? And how are you feeling? I can intellectually understand the concern and the desire to do that, trying to feel like there's something to do, but at the same time, it just becomes kind of puts up more of a barrier to between that relationship in that relationship. It kind of, because irritation is another common what's the word I'm looking for, symptom, and yeah, so that can kind of maybe draw a bigger wedge. So you got to be a bit careful in approaching a friend or a loved one, and try not to make a diagnosis for them. But having a real heart-to-heart conversation and just expressing concern, maybe mentioning, noticing somebody's change in behavior, or you used to sit quite a bit. Are you still doing that? I remember you seemed your mood or your disposition seemed more open or something to that extent. My grandmother, towards the end of her life, she was clearly in a severe depressed state, and she was always complaining about not being being able to eat the food, or not enjoying food, and having a poor appetite, and nauseous, and those are very common symptoms of depression with anxiety. And so she, with some encouragement, she got a second opinion from a doctor, because her first doctor was probably treating her for probably giving her antacids or something, who knows. But so we got her to get a second opinion and got a definite diagnosis of depression, was given a prescription for the SSRI, And so she started taking it, but then just kind of, as I think the statistic is something like 50% of people stop taking it just after a couple months, even though it's been shown for SSRIs to help people, like 50% of people find relief with them. But yeah, so there's the kind of difficulty of dealing with somebody in their habits, especially when they're older, and also I imagine for some people, if it's going to be a parent, their kind of hesitation to take advice from a child, depending on what their relationship has been. But yeah, I think to go back to that text, that question is, there's going to be a lot more helpful and well thought out advice if you can seek out some of these websites that help with that. There's plenty out there. It's not too hard to search. Just try to find one that has some. Like anything, that you can go down the rabbit hole of online research and find plenty of bad advice. So, starting with a nationally recognized source would be a good place to start. Mayo Clinic has a good website on that. Many of the research universities and hospitals will have that. I was going to mention the use of social media in a constructive way. As Angela Hakula mentioned in the last Zenbo issue of her finding social media be very helpful in not feeling isolated in one's situation. We often hear so much of how social media is ruining society and we're all going to, you know, just be so much more worse off. But it's a tool like anything else, and you can use it in a constructive way or destructive. And it reminds me of just heard an interview with Kevin Kelly. He was the founder of Wired magazine, and I think it was an interview with Krista Tippett, the On Being podcast. And he made the point, because I think she brought up, you know, the concern of children being raised on social media and what's it doing to society. And he made the point that, you know, social media as we know it is only about 5,000 days old. It's still so very new. So like any technology that we've developed over the years, it's created waves, and we've had to, as a society, learn how to use it, how to find a healthy use for different technologies or something that benefits society. So, there's I've found podcasts, and although I'm not on Facebook or social media to any real extent, just finding some of those sorts of discussions on there can be helpful. Yeah.
It seems inherent in our practice that we let go of stuff. And sometimes I found it difficult or frightening. I get sashin, you know, to let go.
Yeah.
Let go. And I wonder how that figures in with depression. Not having passed a koan, even passing a koan, I let go of that experience.
Yeah,
we don't know what will happen in the next moment.
Right,
and even in our prajnaparamita, you know, it tells us, you know,
yeah,
nothing. There's nothing to hold on to, But it seems an inherently depressing condition unless we let go of it. I wonder, what is that dynamic? Have you found that really helpful?
Yeah, I've actually, I think in a way I've found the kind of the depression has been helpful in a sense. Not that I would tell anybody to go seek it out as a way to improve your Zen practice, yeah, going back to when I, you know, okay, when I passed Mu, then left, got married, and went off and then soon after decided to go back to grad school. And for several years, I wasn't sitting at all. Maybe come in, a Sunday here or there, but I was just so consumed with grad school. And when I got to the Wyoming, it feels like grad school just kind of drove me into the ground, and that was it. That's why I took a leave of absence and then left. And then finally was diagnosed with what was called dysthymia, which is a kind of persistent low-grade depression, and then having major depressive episodes. When I started kind of really taking that seriously and treating it, kind of the first thing was, okay, getting prescribed the antidepressants. And that was a difficult step for me, but then it gave me the motivation and to then come back out in the world, because at that time I was very withdrawn for a good couple of months, and I remember having the feeling of just so much despair, and thinking, well, when I started getting that treatment, kind of having the motivation to say, okay, I at least got to try. I've got to make an effort, and that kind of got me to start coming back here and having the relationships that I've developed over the years, the people who were practicing here, everybody was still here and still doing their thing. And, I was kind of dropped off the map, but then it was just having that sangha. But then getting the motivation to go back to Sesshin. And I think kind of having that sense of being at the lowest point of having nothing to lose, really. I mean, kind of gave me the sense of being open to that. Maybe it was, facing, really getting down there and facing kind of the death on a real personal level. That may have been helpful, but that Sesshin that I came back to after even not sitting for so long, I remember it being really, really easy in the sense of physically. Not sitting, I was expecting just my body to be tortured or mentally, but it was just such a relief to. It was like riding a bike, getting back on the practice, and being back there. But yeah, I think, getting back to your question, your point about, that fear, anxiety of letting go. I think, that's everybody has that to some sense. And for some people, there is a bit more of a fear response. And going back to John's talk last week, when he had mentioned the book that he was using last week in his talk for the what's it called? Why Buddhism is Right?
Why Buddhism is True.
By Robert Wright. That's where they're right. Yeah, you're dealing with a dyslexic, just depressive. So the words are getting all mixed up. I remember. It might have been an interview with him several years ago, something else I saw. So I started getting in my mind, trying to see things from an evolutionary perspective of these, you know, how we live our lives, and you know, that hesitation or that anxiety to let go of the self, you know, it's probably a physical reaction that's kind of just within some of us to be more hesitant. And for some people over tens of thousands of years, that gene has propagated and been helpful in some ways. I mean, there's many things I look back at what I've done and realize, or am surprised that, you know, I'm still alive, and you know, that my genes, if I had chosen to to procreate, they wouldn't have lasted very long, because I was putting myself in some dangerous situations. But maybe that's part of it. Just you know, I have a unhealthy, what would be considered unhealthy, tolerance of risk, or had. I definitely, it's changed getting out of my younger years. But I don't know, is that
is there any answer that you found? It is
keep sitting. I think a lot of it comes down to, for me, it came down to getting that moment of really trusting the teacher, trusting the practice. You know, so many things that we hear Roshi or anybody say for encouragement talks, or, you know, I'll hear something that I've heard dozens of times in Sesshin, and then still to this day, I'll hear something that's like, I hear it in a totally different way, or see it from a different perspective. Like, you know, Roshi's been saying that for years, and it's like, you know, finally it just sunk in. Like, yeah, like, you know, we keep getting in the way of ourselves, or it's trusting that practice. Or, you know, I think he often will say, you know, we have to trust that the Buddha was neither lying nor mistaken, something like that. And there's plenty of evidence and millennia.
You think the Buddha knew what he was talking about?
Maybe. There's, you know, there's been some scholars who suggested that that the Siddhartha was likely a severely depressed person as well, dealing with that. Of course, we can't really know. Then we hear stories of, like, Hakuin, who, you know, from armchair diagnosis, would likely be considered bipolar or manic depressive. And yeah, I think I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of the people who are drawn to Zen, and there's probably a high percentage who do lean more towards the depressive side, who are drawn to Zen because, you know, try so much to satisfy that pain, or I think for some people it's kind of a last resort, or I don't know. I mean, for me, it was I didn't seek out Zen. I think I told my story in the last time, but it was kind of a mistake, or, you know, by accident. I came to the center and just realized that I just felt that this was the place to be, and just the rest is history. But yeah, I mean, I wish, again, probably paraphrasing Roshi at some point, you know, I wish there was something I could say or do to, you know, to let everybody, you know, pass their koan, or, but it is that letting go. It's, maybe just finally getting so fed up, and, realizing that there's no amount of information or things that we can do to really wake up and realize our true self, our true nature. And then after you do pass that first koan, it's you keep tripping up and realizing, but again, like, you know, having that confidence of going, at least going down the right hallway. That's a big part.
I've been chanting and doing repentance gata, and I find it very helpful and moving, and feels like a link also to the Sangha and the whole world of people striving to something.
Yeah, it's definitely my relationship to the devotional and ritualistic portions of Zen has definitely changed over the years. At first, it was, you know, I don't need any of that mumbo jumbo or whatever, you know. It's prostrations and the chanting and the whatever. But again, it's through those really difficult times that becomes kind of a mooring or an anchor point, where, you know, in the middle of sesshin, if I'm in a really, really crappy mood, and my body knows how to do a prostration and to chant, and you know, that just feel like it just feels right, and I've definitely that sense has ripened over the years of being able to appreciate that. You know, and in another sense, I think something that I got tripped up with over the years is thinking, okay, I'm a Buddhist, I gotta help others and this and that, and you know, not be so selfish, and kind of maybe thinking that turning inward was kind of being selfish, or thinking that, you know, I couldn't, that me feeling healthy or good would be selfish in some way. And so you can kind of see it with some people, in many places, and not just at the center, but kind of the need to always be maybe helping others, or just want to be a good person, and but ignoring oneself. And one thought that comes to mind is the instructions on an airplane for, you know, when the oxygen mask drop, you know, put yours on first, then you're going to be better used to other people, the children and those around you. So it's kind of like, you know, realize that, you know, we are connected to each other, and learning to kind of I guess love oneself is going to allow you to be more open to others and help others, right?
Yes.
And yeah, I think I mentioned to you before, Jim, how grateful I was with when you invited me to be a part of the prison group when you were gone last year, because at first I was quite hesitant, not, you know, just because all these thoughts that I had of what it was, but then getting there and, okay, these horrible people, these criminals, just realizing that really could have been me, because of whatever circumstances, people with mental illness do bad things. Some of them get caught and they end up in prison. Mm-hmm. And, you know, meeting these guys who, you know, realizing, okay, they're human beings, they're suffering. And that was a really enriching experience, and yeah, I hope to get back to doing that in the future. But yeah, just kind of reflecting on that based on my circumstances, you know, there are many times where I could have easily gone down that path, and mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, me too.
So yeah, it's a mysterious mysterious thing, but. I think part of this as well, the way my approach to this is, anybody who knows me, I'm just kind of compulsively always trying to fix things and get my hands on things and figure stuff out, and in a way that's what this has become. I just got distracted by a text. So maybe this wasn't a good idea. So somebody remind me what I was just talking about.
Fixing things.
Thank you. Yeah. So that's kind of how I've been approaching this. Is, you know, like trying to figure it out and just kind of getting into it and trying to separate the self from it just not getting too caught up in it, and just trying to take a step back, see that we're a bunch of little ants in a way, going around, and there's this larger picture of how we're interacting and how we're living our life, let's see the one. Oh yeah, just various theories for causes of this. I mean, it's, we can, you know, think, oh, I'm, this happened to me or that happened to me as a child, or that's why I'm broken. But to take a step back and look at, you know, what's the situation that we're living in now with, you know, world population is exploded. There's so many people. There's plenty of pollution and all that stress. The chronic isolation and loneliness from just modern living. And it's, you know, not to, we can either say, oh my God, this world is so horrible. It's all this stuff, all this pollution. But at the same time, it's what we've got. It's where we are. We can get overwhelmed with it, or we can try to, you know, find a way to survive, really, and try to find a way to engage with people and improve things.
I wonder if, I'm sure everyone experiences this in their own way, a numbness, because I went through depression, a big one, and still take medication for it. But for me, and I can only speak for myself, I just become numb.
Yeah, yeah.
This incredible numbness, and to the point where everything even looks gray.
Yeah, yeah.
And the thing of it is it is accompanied by a lot of negative thinking, as you described. I somehow think that, you know, to say it's sadness is not accurate.
Right.
But that numbness for me was huge. I just wasn't in touch even. So came close to suicide, but when I was examined, they said, I didn't have plan or intent. I just
right, right.
So at any rate, coming out of it, I did need some therapy and the meds. It seems like almost you have to have both.
Yeah, it's. From what I've read and seen, you know, it's a very individualized treatment for some people. The cognitive behavioral therapy works great, and meds don't. For me, Zoloft and coffee in the morning, I'm good to go. but that numbness that you had mentioned, I think that's what some people just don't understand. When if somebody who hasn't really experienced a full-on major depressive episode, they might, you know, try to think about it in terms of, okay, oh yeah, I was sad, or I you know, in the wintertime, I'm getting the blues, a seasonal affective disorder. And, you know, for that, I can see, yeah, I get definitely get lower mood in the winter, and the seasonal affective disorder, I think we can see, again, relating to that evolutionary response, it would make sense way back when, if in the middle of winter, if we weren't so active and there's not as much food supply, and we just kind of are essentially kind of hibernating. But now we live in the time of, you know, we've got to be productive and be good capitalists and always be moving. So it's becomes a hindrance. But it's a different animal from a full on depressive episode. And yeah, that I can totally relate to that. Everything being gray, you know, just food not tasting like anything, really. Just everything just tastes like cardboard. Yeah, it's interesting. We're running out of time, but I was going to go into this. I was going to mention something. A lot of research going into this idea of depression being a physiological response similar to what they call the animal sickness behavior, where we as animals or other animals, if we get injured or sick, we tend to have the same response of an inflammation within the body, a desire to withdraw, not to infect others within the pack. And so there's a lot going on with that. And I have another article here, but I see it's already 10:30. So John, thoughts?
Yeah, thanks, John.
Okay.
We probably should.
Yeah. It's okay. We'll do a part three, and we'll just keep going. It'll. I mean, Donna mentioned the other day that you know, it seemed like something. It sounds like the group that Wayman and Errol have been leading with the Zen of Living and Dying. That, you know, something like that might be helpful for mental health, depression. I said, yeah, that'd be a great idea. I'm not the one to lead it, but yeah, I mean, that's something that I think is probably going to be, would be useful to some people, and but yeah, to figure out another time.
Yeah. I really appreciated the whole touching on the whole question of letting go and trust.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just so key to practice.
Yeah.
Okay, Cecily.
All beings without number,
I bow to liberate endless blind passions. I bow to uproot dharma.